Hope everybody had a good night's rest, and looking forward to three presentations today. And certainly hope that that you'll get your Bibles out. And someone told me one time I had a little sports car, and they called me a speed racer. And so that kind of stuck for a little bit. But I'm going to be a speed racer this morning. I'm going to, first part of this lesson really is to get us all on the same page. It's a lesson within itself. And then we're going to talk about how the addicted family is modified from the traditional standard that should be there. So I'm going to invite you to just sit back and hold on tight, and we're going to be taking off here. Okay. The subject of substance abuse and the family, we see families today that are in a great deal of trouble. As a matter of fact, there's been a great breakdown in the family. Even family has been defined in so many different ways, to where people are confused today about what a family is and what a marriage is and so forth. So it always behooves us to go back at times like that, to go back to God's standard. I want to suggest in the very beginning that there are no perfect families, that most families are dysfunctional in some way. So if someone talks about a dysfunctional family, they're really talking about all families. But the degree of dysfunction will vary. All families have room to grow. If we are going to have the kind of homes God wants us to have, then instead of working on how to break up a marriage, how to tear it apart, we need to look at how to build it up. And that needs to be the focus of the Christian home, is how we're going to help each other get to heaven, how we support and encourage one another. I believe that all of us by nature are somewhat selfish. That is, that if you do it my way, we'll get along fine. But the problem is, if we've got two or more people in the family and everybody's wanting to do it their way, we're not going to be able to do it all those ways. So we're going to have conflict, and we're going to have differences of opinion, differences of direction on how we're going to handle certain things. So that is going to play into our family life. I want to do first a brief overview of the home as God would have it. This is where you hold on to your seat, okay? God designed one man for one woman for life. That is, as in the old days when we had pop bottles, it was no deposit, no return. And that's the same thing with marriage, that when you make your commitment, you commit yourself to stay with that marriage. In the marriage vows, we commit ourselves to keep ourselves for you and for you alone until death shall separate us. That's usually the type of vow or promise that is made. But unfortunately, there are many people that that don't honor their vows. When we make this statement, I will keep myself for you and for you alone, guess who that excludes? Excludes me. That you're the only outlet that I can have for the rest of my life. I've chosen you as the only outlet for this marriage relationship and the things that go with it. And therefore, as 1 Corinthians 7 teaches, that this is not only exclusive, but it is focused at each partner in the marriage providing something for the other. And that's not just in the sexual realm, it's in all realms in marriage that we support and complement one another. God has ordained that marriage is for a lifetime, and that anyone who, that the only thing God allows as something that can sever that bond is if there's a cheating mate. Now, I'm very aware in the book of Malachi, God says, I hate putting away. But I'll tell you something God hates worse, and that is a cheating mate. And I say that God hates that worse because God allows what he hates. The putting away when there is unfaithfulness, sexual unfaithfulness in the marriage. As a matter of fact, it comes as a surprise to some that God himself divorced Israel. He gave her a writing of divorcement, put her away, according to the book of Jeremiah. So God did what he hated. God allows what he hates in the circumstance where there is unfaithfulness or disloyalty in the sexual way to the mate. Otherwise, there's a glue that bonds us together. Now, here's what the wife is, the obligations of the wife. By the way, you can have these PowerPoints and just bring your flash drive and copy them off, or someone will help you do that. But in marriage, 1 Peter 3:7 says the husband is to give honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, being joint heirs of the grace of life. Honoring the wife means to treat her with respect, mingled with love. Okay? I don't know what I did. I did something. Means to respect mingled with love. We're logging off. Okay. All right.
One from technology.
Yes. Well, I can talk the old-fashioned way, too. I've got my notes in front of me. All right, so treating our spouse with honor has to do with respecting her. And respecting her means we talk about her, about our wife, respectfully. We don't talk behind her back and run her down, but we treat her with honor and with dignity. And I tell you what, that's a problem in a lot of marriages today. And why some marriages are having problems is because the honor's not there. And other things fall out when that happens. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 3 through 6, we find that the woman is to be properly adorned. That is, that she dresses herself appropriately. She doesn't go out here and flaunt herself for other men to look at or to gaze upon. And then we read in Titus 2 and verse 5 that a woman is her job, her primary role, is to be a keeper at home. Now, I emphasize that says she's a keeper at home, it doesn't tell you keeper at home, okay? So she is to be one that her role is she's the queen of the house, and that's the domain that God put her in primarily. That's not to say others can't join in with that, but she's kind of the boss. There around the home. And there, her job is to make a home for the family, and her husband has another role we'll talk about. She's also to be in subjection to her husband. Ephesians 5:22 and also 1 Peter 3 and verse 1 talk about. And this subjection to the husband is something the wife does voluntarily. The command to be in subjection is not to the husband. It doesn't say, husbands, make your wives submit to you. Instead, what it says is, and you wives, subject yourself to your husbands, or to your husband. In this case, what we find is this is a voluntary surrender of oneself to a subservient kind of role here. And the message here is that as the wife is subject to her husband, the husband is obligated to provide an environment to where that subjection is not torture. In other words, if he does what he's supposed to do, then it's relatively easy to be in subjection to someone like that. But if this man's a tyrant and doesn't have your best interest in mind and is threatening, and if he's out of line like that, it is extremely difficult to be in subjection to somebody like that. And so we get dysfunction going on. The husband has the obligation to be the primary provider. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8, if any provide not for his own, and especially those of his own household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So the passage here teaches that husband is a provider. And it not only says that he provides for his immediate family, but he also looks at the extended family. For he provides for his own, and especially, there's a subcategory, those of his own household. In other words, the husband's job as a provider is to reach out to his blood relatives and to assist the family as much as possible. Did you know God had this plan here before Social Security and before welfare systems and giveaway programs? This plan was already here. And God's plan does work. Family takes care of family. That's the message. The husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, Ephesians 5:25. So this is a sacrificial love. This is not a love that says, okay, I'm going to come in the door, where's my food, and whiten the house clean, and barking and hollering, and you know, just coming in and throwing a hissy fit. That's not what husbands are supposed to do. Husbands are supposed to love their wives like Christ loved the church. What's the model for what a husband does? The model is Jesus and how he treats his church. That's how a man's supposed to treat his wife and to love her in that way. He is also the spiritual leader of his family. Ephesians 6:4 says, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them in the chastening and admonition of the Lord." In that passage, he tells husbands that they are the spiritual leaders, that you teach your children, training up that child in the way they should go. That's not the primary role of the wife, although she is a partner in that. But it is, okay, but it is, thank you. Unless it goes out again, then we'll have to thank you twice. All right.
I pushed the wrong button.
Oh, did I? Was that my fault?
I think so.
All right, well, all right, I'll take the blame. Get the whips and the chains out. Okay, well, I'm just going to hit up and down here. All right, so the husband is to, he's the spiritual leader in the family. And what this means is that his children, he needs to role model that this family follows God. And that's how God set this up. And then he is to nourish and cherish his wife, Ephesians 5 and verse 29. Let's see if I get this the other way. He's to nourish his wife and cherish his wife. The word cherish means to treat her with tender, loving care, something that is not only honored, but is valued. This is a person of value. And he is to nourish, that means to feed the marriage, feed the relationship. Well, that would be the roles of a husband and a wife, but in the family, as God would have it, both of the husband and wife are to be sexually available to each other. In 1 Corinthians 7, it talks about defraud not one another, except it be by consent for a season, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer. The break in the sexual relationship is for the purpose of giving focus to some serious problem that's going on, and then you're given that dedication in fasting and prayer. And then it says, and that as you come back together again, that Satan tempt you not through your incontinency. And what he says there is that a separation is intended to be brief, not permanent. A break in the sexual relationship is not intended to be for the rest of a person's life, but is intended to be a short-term thing and to be something that is mutually agreed upon by the marriage partners. I see a lot of homes breaking up today and a lot of problems with pornography and other kinds of sexual things, and largely when I talk to those that are violating their marriage vows that way, then I also talk to the other partner, and I get some pretty strange answers about the frequency of their sexual relationship. Notice I didn't use the word intimacy, because intimacy is not about sex. Intimacy is about relationship. When we have a relationship where we are as one and we care for each other and we feel loved and we feel nurtured and we feel like we belong, and not that we're the old man or we're the old woman in the relationship, dishonored, disrespected, when we have that, then we have breaks in other kinds of things in the marriage. But in the home, as God would have it, husbands and wives are to be sexually available. Children in the home are to be obedient to their parents. Now, what that says is that God put a rule in order that the parents are in charge, not the children. But have you seen homes where it looks like the children are in charge, that they run the home? Well, the husband and wife are together to run the home. Romans 1 and verse 31, among the other things that these people did on their journey downward to being on the roll call of the lost, in that journey downward, it says they were disobedient to parents. They didn't learn respect for any authority. And so they just did whatever they wanted to do. Well, shame on mom and dad for tolerating that, and shame on the child for doing that, because God holds them accountable. Romans 1 talks about that. We need also to avoid favoritism in a home. Jacob and Esau would be examples of those that were chosen to be chosen as favorites. And we see what that did and the ramifications of that that ended up being a national issue for Jacob and Esau's family as they move forward and progressed. Train the child in the nurture and admonition of the Lord in the ways of the Lord. Deuteronomy 6 talks about that we talk to our children about God. When we're in the byway and when we post it over the lintels of our door and that we're talking about God, we're keeping our mind focused on godly things. Now, I want to suggest to you that many families have fallen into the digital trap. That is that we may be together, but we're not together. We're out here on our cell phones or on our digital devices or our gaming tools, and what we do is we are in the same house, but we have a silo effect where we're together, but we're really not together. And I want to suggest to you that our digital devices, that industry has grown so rapidly and is continuing to grow rapidly that many people have not stopped to consider what are the rules. I'm glad to see many families that what they will do is they will, when you come into the house, you check in your digital devices, put them in a basket here, turn them off, put them in a basket, and this is family time. And so we have family time. Does anybody eat dinner together anymore? Dinner, supper, whatever you call it. You know, back in the day, I can recall at my grandparents' house, we would sit around the kitchen table. And that kitchen table, we had lots of conversations. We heard family stories, and yes, we heard the jokes over and over and over and over again. And if we didn't get it that time, we heard them over again. But there were family stories, and there was family bonding happened at the dinner table, check-in time for the family. And a lot of families are so busy today, they don't have time to be together. So what they do is they live in the same place, but they're almost like roommates in a house rather than a cohesive family. Turn stuff off. Spend time together with your family and talk about the things that are important. That's how God would have it to be. Training our children in the ways of the Lord. And then honoring our father and mother. The word honor means to have respect for mom and dad and mingle that with love. We don't dishonor our parents. We don't talk back to them. We don't put them down. We don't treat them like there's just some old school person that doesn't know anything. That's not how you treat a parent. What you treat your parent as is with honor and with dignity, with respect. And that is the will of God, according to Ephesians 6, 1 and 2. Well, in terms of parenting, the parents have the obligation to provide love, nurturing, caring, and also to set a positive example for them. Discipline in a home is not something that we do out of frustration, but it is something that we do as an act of love. James Dobson long ago said discipline is done for the child, not something you do to the child. So let us be careful in our discipline that we look at what that word discipline means. Do you see the word disciple in that? Because that's what discipline is. We are discipling our kids in a particular modality, a particular way of life. We are teaching them the discipline of following God. You see how that fits in there? And we're teaching them to follow God, to honor God, and at first, the discipline is instructive discipline. We want to teach you what is expected, to set down what the rules are. And then, if those rules aren't followed, then there is punitive discipline. And that can take many forms. But someone asked me the question, usually I'm asked the question, do I believe it's wrong to spank a child? And no, I do not. I believe the Bible teaches that, but I don't believe that's the only form of discipline. We can have graduated discipline in the home, but yes, sometimes corporal punishment in the form of spanking, certainly that is authorized and taught in the Bible. And it says over in Proverbs that the one that withholds the rod hates his child. Now, that's not a big old broomstick thing where you mutilate a kid, but instead it's something that we reinforce, in this case with pain, what the rules are. Discipline is something that we do for the child. And I also suggest that not all kids are the same. I have three children, My first one, if I look across the room at her, even now, she's a full-grown adult now, if I look across the room in a disapproval, she'll probably get a tear in her eye because that's who she is. But my second one, if I look across the room at her and she realizes I'm not happy and I'm out of arm's length, she'll just grin at me. That they're not the same kid. Now my third one is a son. And my third one, what he will do is he just kind of stands there and looks at me, kind of not knowing what to do. God blessed our family with him. And poor boy, he can't lie. Because when he lies, he gets nervous. When he gets nervous, his eyes twitch. And he gives himself away every time. And I tell him, Wayne, you've got to tell me the truth. I know you're not telling me the truth here. And you know, and I know that because his automatic twitchy eye goes into effect. Not all kids are the same. Sometimes people say, well, I don't know what went wrong in my family. I treated all my kids the same. That's what went wrong. Because they're not all the same. Let me show you that. In Ephesians 4, it says, and you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Sometimes what happens in discipline with some children is we drive them to rebellion, to wrath. We overdo it. And this passage says that. But there's a passage that looks parallel, but it isn't. And it's in Colossians 3:21. And what it says, and you fathers, provoke not your children, lest they be discouraged. Now there's a difference in provoking them to wrath and discouraging them. And what he's saying here is some children, if you over-discipline, what you will do is you will break their spirit. Other children, when you discipline them, what you do is you drive them to rebellion and to basically standing up against you, against authority. Two different kinds of children, two extremes. We don't go to either one of those extremes. And that's what he says here, and that's why I would say that not all children are the same. Well, over time, the roles reverse. And mom and dad reach an age where they need the kids to pay more attention to them. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4, we find that we are to requite our parents. In other words, the word requite means to pay back or to render to them their due. They took care of us when we took care of them when they took care of us when we were little and we couldn't take care of ourselves. They put food on the table and they took care of our needs or whatever. When mom and dad get to that stage as the roles reverse, then the children are obligated, required by God, to take care of their parents. You see that? Now that was written a long time before there was nursing homes and institutions, and I'm not against those. But if those are being used as just a means to get rid of mom and dad because they're a problem, then we need to look at that real closely. If there is a need for the care that is provided there, then certainly those are convenient places and helpful places for our parents. But we need to look at what are our motives as we would assign our parents to something like that. The role God has is that family takes care of family, and over time, the roles reverse, and the children are taking care of the parents. And that's part of requiting or paying back for what the parents have done with us. Well, the problem is when, that was the short version. We could talk about all that. But over time, what happens in an addictive family is that order, if it was ever in place, that order is broken. And when we're talking with people that have addiction problems, whatever the nature of the addiction is, when we talk to those people, there is not only a problem with that individual that they are responding to, but there is something they are responding to, and often it's happening at home. In other words, addicts usually don't act independently of the systems that have fostered them. That's not to say always it's the problem of the family, but sometimes the families are toxic, and sometimes they generate things in that family that are not healthy. Now, with a toxic family, we've got problem of love and loyalty, plus also we may be learning some things at home and some patterns in the home that are extremely unhealthy and that actually help that addiction to stay in place. Let's talk about that just a little bit. Erosion can happen in a family. Here's a definition we know about addiction. The addicted family can become or the addict or the alcoholic can become dependent on the chemical, but the family can become dependent, can become addicted to the addict. And what that means is that we become codependent, or we become enablers. We help this dysfunctional system of addiction to stay in place. How does that happen? An example would be where, and this would be a real example, would be where mom and dad knew that the son had a problem, but they didn't want people at church to know that, and they didn't want people in the community to know that, and so mom and dad tried to sit on the problem and to avoid that, getting out this secret. And addictive families often are families of secrets. We don't want these things told so we don't look bad as a family. But this thing got worse and worse. The young man ended up in jail. The parents went down and bailed him out. By the way, one of the best things you can do for a person who is an addict that ends up in jail is leave them there. Jail's not the worst thing. I've had a number of people who've said in some of the addiction groups that have said, you know, jail was the best thing happened to me, or prison was the best thing happened to me. Now, to me, that would be one of the worst things that happened to me. But for them, what they say is, that woke me up. Now, not all of them say that. But just because something happens to the addicted person doesn't mean we got to run down and fix it right away. There is a need to allow someone's sins to find them out. When we take away the pain, then we take away the motivation for them to get better. When you take away the pain, what's left? The joy of using the drugs, the joy of being drunk, the joy of going out and doing what you want to do. And mom and dad or somebody out here is going to fix that for us, a husband or a wife, a boyfriend or girlfriend. They'll fix it for us so that I can still play out here without any real consequences. It is when there are consequences, until the pain of the addiction is greater than the pleasure of the addiction, that person's going to remain in their addiction. So while that may sound harsh, they need to come face to face with what they have done and the seriousness, the consequences of what they've done. It's not our role to take those away. I tell people, you need to tell your addicted family member, I will help you get better, but I will not help you stay sick. I will not help you to remain an addict. I didn't go out and provide this home that you live in order for you to make it a dope den or to bring things in here that don't belong in here. This is our house, and in a healthy family, it's our house, our rules. You don't want to follow those rules? Then you really don't want to live here, and maybe you need to look at the alternative. People sometimes are fearful that, well, if we tell them, maybe you need to leave, maybe you're not welcome here, or you're bringing all this stuff in, you need to leave. We get these dread ideas of the worst thing could happen to them. I tell you what, sometimes those things do happen. But sometimes what happens is a few nights on the street might teach you to appreciate the things that you have at home. That sounds harsh. But when a person chooses a lifestyle that is contrary to what God wants, then they choose what goes with that lifestyle. I want you to also notice in Luke chapter 15 that the prodigal son's father did not leave home and go chase after him into a foreign country. He didn't go try to chase him down. But here's what the prodigal son always knew. He always knew where home was. And he always felt like he would be welcome there, even though the circumstances of welcome might be different. Yes, he knew where home was. But daddy didn't chase him, follow him down, beg him to come home, say, well, we'll lighten up on the rules, we'll let you live like you want to live. No. Prodigal son's father did differently on that. One in four children today live in a home where alcohol is used daily. And with the alcohol, we get a lot of effects that happen in those homes. I talked with one family, and the husband and wife, they were just very adamant that our 4-year-old and our 7-year-old don't know that daddy drinks or drinks and gets drunk. like nasty drunk. They don't know that. We keep that away from them. So in the course of conversation, I ask, well, your children in the other room, let's bring them in and just chat with them, see what's going on. So I asked little Michelle, and I asked her, I said, can you tell me something about your dad? And she looked at me square in the eye, you know, a look that would be not a child look, but a look of wisdom and observation. And she looked me square in the eye and she says, which dad? Drunk dad or real dad? The four-year-old knew what was going on. I looked at the parents. They had not hidden their secret, and they had not talked about it, and this child had all this inside of her. So we spent some time with her, apart from the family, and worked with her and with her seven-year-old sister. But one in four children lived there, to where the normal thing in the home is you come home, if you're a female, and you bring your friends home with you from school, daddy may be trying to hit on your schoolmates. You may be walking up the driveway and someone's laying out in the driveway, passed out drunk, and you just step over and walk in the house. And your friends look at you like, weren't you going to help him? It's like, nah, he does that all the time. That's normal in some homes. That's their normal. Now, when people come into our services, and we carry our own issue and our own baggages, but when people come into our service, sometimes there's something's gone on in that home, and it's hard to get your mind focused on what we're doing here and on the lesson. And when we leave, we would like to leave with some refreshment and some tools to know, how am I going to deal with what's at home? And we may even avoid going home. We may make excuses all the time not to go home. There are sometimes husbands who don't want to go home, because the minute they turn toward the driveway, they're wondering, when I walk in the house, am I going to be walking on eggshells? You know, are things crazy in there? Do I get the lowdown on what my child did today? And then it's left for me to fix. Am I going to get blasted? Do we get the cold shoulder? What's going to go on? And home is not an oasis. Home is a war zone. That's how it is in the addicted family, where people don't honor the roles that God placed there for them. Anybody been there? Some have. Some have. If I were to ask the audience, and I won't do it today, but how many of you have your lives affected by someone that has an alcohol or drug problem? And I would expect to have at least 33% of you raise your hand. That's how bad the problem is today, and the dysfunction in the homes. When we work with these people to evangelize and to bring them out of this kind of a setting, to come out from the world, this is what we're asking them to come out of. But then they've got a loyalty to mom and dad. Remember those rules that we honor father and mother and all that? Sometimes parents make that very difficult. Sometimes the children make it difficult. You know, how do I do what God's asked me to do when they're doing what they do? And the answer to that is that you take care of your side of the street. To the best of your ability, you honor those passages, but you're not responsible for the other side of the street. All you can take care of is the peace that is yours. You do the next right thing. Sometimes it is the best thing to put some distance between us and the toxic environment that we're in. Sometimes we are going to have trouble living in a home like that, where this craziness, this insanity goes on. And we may need to put some distance there. The children that come out of these addicted families are at greater risk for mental illness, depression, anxiety, mood disorders, health problems, learning difficulties, and also getting back into substance abuse. You see, when we inject into a family this kind of dysfunction, what we do is we throw the balance of the family off. And when the balance is off, other people they adjust to living an abnormal family life. So when we get the pieces back in place, people are doing their part, then the family is out of balance again because we don't know how to live this way. I remember one fellow's a heroin addict, and I was talking with him about how to live. And I was noticing he's getting more and more nervous, and he was rocking. And I asked him, his name was James. I asked him, James, what's wrong? And he started crying. And he said, Art, I don't know how to live that way. He said, I have lived 30 years on the streets. I don't know how to live this way. You know, I don't know how to be a dad to my daughter, who was also an adult by that time. And he said, I don't know how to do that. And you know, I believe he was being very honest with me, is that he had lived a whole different kind of life and didn't understand how to live a life like God's rules are. So what did we have to do? We had to start with scratch. Here's what God wants you to do. And I suggest that just because someone is baptized or because someone comes back from the world and they're restored doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be able to pick up and take off where we are. They have to be taught and instructed and helped. And that's part of what we do when we're helping addicted families, is we have to be there for them to encourage them. No wonder older women are to teach the younger women to love their husbands, to be keepers at home, and so forth. And no wonder that we have men today who don't know what the role of a man is. They think the role of a man is to see how many women you can conquer. That's not the role of a man. That's not a man at all. God has obligations that we have as male and female. And yes, there's only two genders. But God has obligations for us, and we need to step up to meet our role in those ways. All right. The addicted one often becomes the focus of the family. Do I have five more minutes? Okay. All right. So the addicted one often becomes the focus of the family. And we identify the addicted one as, well, that's the troublemaker. That's the sick one. But I want to suggest to you that some others in the family may be sicker. They may not be the addict, but their way of coping with stuff is so insane that the addict is the result of something else going on in the family. So sometimes the addict's to blame, and some addict alcoholic, and sometimes there's something going on in the family that is generating this kind of problem. All right. The family then, in the addicted family, becomes a family of secrets. And here's the secrets. Don't trust, don't feel, and don't tell. In other words, we've got a closed system. And so we don't talk about what goes on behind closed doors. It may be that at night, maybe someone's running their hand up under the cover of one of their family members, and we got incest going on, sexual abuse going on. That happens in a number of homes, addicted homes. We may have problems in the home with people hiding illegal stuff in the home. But in the public image, when we go out, we have that smile on our face, and we put on that public image because we don't want the neighbors to know who we really are. And if we're going to church services, we don't want them to know who we really are, what's really going on. And I want to suggest to you this, and I'm going to say this, it sounds harsh, but if you're not a Christian everywhere, you're probably not a Christian anywhere. Christianity doesn't stop when the door opens. Christianity goes in that door. Someone asked the question, who's the head of your house? And many times we say, well, the husband is, but the husband's not the head of the house. Christ is in the Christian family. I know that because 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 1 and 2 says that. Well, all right, so let me finish this up here. Insanity is going to surround the addict. That this person who's in the addictive lifestyle, they are doing whatever it takes to protect their habit, to protect their addiction. And what that means is that things get real crazy at home and hiding stashes. So Friday night's experience for the family is, well, while they're out, let's go look in the light sockets, and let's go lift up the carpet, and let's look at places in the wheel wells of the cars and see where their stash is and see if they got a pipe or something in there. Know what I mean? And so I'll tell you what, most families don't spend Friday night that way. A normal family doesn't do it that way. But the family can get crazy trying to play these crazy games, catch me if you can. That's the addicted home. Where is he? Where is she? When are they coming home? Who are they with? And so the occupation our minds are preoccupied with their addiction and not necessarily focused on the things that need to happen in the normal course of time. So when they are away from home, we want to know where they are. If they're staying out too late, we're laying there, we can't go to sleep because we're afraid the phone's going to ring and they're going to tell us they're laying out in a ditch or they got picked up by the cops or somebody's the drug dealer's calling saying, hey, they owe me some money, and if you don't come down now and pay me, I'm going to kill them. By the way, that does happen. And by the way, most drug dealers don't kill their customers. Why? Because you would have one less customer. So threats can work. But moms and dads can get pulled into that. Mary did. She was there. You know, the drug dealer called me, and he's going to kill my kid if I don't have him having this money that my son charged up, and going to kill him if I don't get down here and pay him. And what I asked Mary, I said, do you realize what you did? She went down and paid the drug dealer, and her son ran another tab for the next week. Crazy stuff. But you know what she did? She went down and paid the drug dealer. I said, let me ask you this. When you stand in front of a guy in a black robe or a woman in a black robe and they're sitting up on a bench with a gavel and you tell them you paid off the drug dealer, you became a part of a drug deal. And you may have to answer for that. That's kind of illegal. All right. Feelings of guilt, shame, and worthlessness are going to characterize this family. They're going to feel less than. The addict is going to feel less than. And the cycle will continue until the addict decides to break the cycle and until the family decides to quit enabling this family member. And that cycle will continue. And guess where it ends up? It ends up with death. Somebody's going to die. Death or insanity. That is the logical end. That is the natural end of this course of addictive families, is that we die. Not a natural death, but someone dies. There will be a funeral, or someone is going to lose their mind over this thing in the process. Thank you so much for listening this morning.